Welcome to a Design for Living Big Book OA meeting. My name is Robin and I'm a compulsive eater and your meeting leader moderator today. To open the meeting, let us have a moment of quiet meditation followed by the set aside prayer. God, please set aside everything I think I know about myself, my recovery, my spiritual path, and you, for an open mind and a new experience with myself, my recovery, my spiritual path, and especially you. We start this meeting by remembering our common purpose to extend the heart and hand of the OA Fellowship to those who still suffer. Let us be mindful of OA's unity with diversity policy, which respects our differences, yet unites us in the solution to our common problem. Whatever problem you may have with food, you are welcome at this meeting. Our topic today is Principle 1, Honesty. We will read a section of the Big Book, hear from our speakers, and move into a guided discussion. The guided discussion is a space for any questions you may have on the reading, on what you heard here today, or on Overeaters Anonymous. And could Jane please read the paragraph on page 58? It's the first full paragraph. Thank you. Of the Big Book.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jane. I'm a compulsive overeater. Chapter 5, this is how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the SIPL program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest.
Thank you, Jane. I would now like to welcome our first speaker, Hannah Kay.
Thanks, Robin. Thank you to everyone who's doing service. Hi, my name's Hannah. I'm a compulsive eater. Very gratefully abstinent today. Firstly, on the topic of honesty, I have to say that I'm very nervous at the moment because one of the things that program has not done for me is turn me into a magnificent public speaker. It's done many great things, but not that. However, there's the big difference because today I can show up. I can show up and I can engage with people and I can show up for life. And I am someone who, I used to not be able to look people in the eye, you know. I would take my daughter to school and I'd just look at the floor and they'd be like, please don't talk to me. You know, I just couldn't deal with being seen, you know. I love to hide. So here I am, you know, giving a talk in front of 51 people on camera, no less. So that's a pretty big miracle in itself. But I just quickly want to talk about my, you know, why I'm here, why I'm a compulsive overeater, or what my relationship is with compulsive overeating. I don't know, I was probably born that way. But from a very early age, I remember that my relationship to food was a little bit different to most people around me. You know, I was someone who was always I was always aware of where the snacks were, what the count was of the candies, when the next meal was happening. I was always hovering around the snacks table at a party. So it was it just was my very first sort of fixation, and it was the first thing that I learned I could use to change how I feel. So for a short while later, I discovered other substances that sort of took the weight off the food. So for a while, it wasn't so prominent, but I got sober in another fellowship when I was 23, and then all food came back with a vengeance, you know, all the weight that the other addictions were shouldering just fell onto the food, and it just got steadily worse. And you know, the people that are not us, that don't have this problem, we're like, no, it's okay, you don't worry, you know, it's just food won't kill you. Well, it's probably true for them, but not for, you know, someone who's a real compulsive overeater such as me. And it just brought me to a place where I was, you know, I actually had two phases. Like, I had either a phase where I was trying to manage it and control it, and I was, you know, the diets and the super plans about how I'm gonna do this. You know, at one point I was like, oh, I'm only gonna eat once a day, because I knew that once I start, I can't stop. So I was like, okay, if I only start once a day, then that will fix the problem. But I, you know, like, neglected to realize that I can eat in one sitting enough for an entire family, you know. So it really didn't work. But that's just one of my very bright ideas about how I'm going to control this thing. So that was the management phase. And then I had the what I call the oblivion phase, which was, you know, in the book, in Bill's story, at some point he says, like, the courage to do battle was not there. And that was the case for me. At certain points, I was like, I'm done. I'm not going to even try and manage this anymore. And I would just, like, binge continually. The curtains would come down, I would hide, and it became very small. Like, my world was just me and the food. And I went through many cycles of this until I stumbled into this very meeting, actually. You know, depressed, isolated, couldn't look people in the face. I had broken relationships. I was overweight, you know, like, just, I was done. And at that point, it wasn't even about control. Like, it wasn't about the weight. It wasn't about how I looked. It was just, I needed the craziness in my head to stop. And so I, you know, was like, just, my sponsor literally fell in my lap. I was so desperate. I just wanted someone to help me. I rang her and I was like, please help me. I can't do this. I don't know what to do. And she did, she helped me. And, you know, I did the work. I went through the book and I did the steps. And one of the things I learned was that what I needed was a new set of ideals, right? One of which is honesty, which is today's topic. So the ideals are like guiding principles, you know, they're like a compass that points sort of the way north for me. It's like, this is the direction in which I want to be traveling. It's where it is what is gonna get me to where I want to be, as opposed to what I was doing before that continually was getting me where I didn't want to be. So it's pretty insane that I'm here talking to you guys about honesty, because I'm someone who was thoroughly dishonest. I would just, in many, many different ways, but, you know, I would open my mouth and lies would just come out. You know, sometimes I didn't even know why I lied, you know, but it was a very second nature thing to me. And so I had to learn about, like, honesty, you know. It was like a new subject in school for me. So one of the things I really, you know, like to do whenever I'm contemplating a new concept or learning something is to look up definitions, because sometimes we think we know what words mean and we actually don't, or even if we do, just looking at the definitions can kind of help me to conceptualize it more. So I'd like to read a few that I have on honesty. So one is adherence to the facts. So the bare facts, no embellishments, no minimizing, no softening or evading, you know, to tell the full facts, and many other tactics that I can employ to not just stick to the facts. Another one is straightforwardness of conduct. I mean, how amazing. Like, I don't know if, you know, like, you have experience, any of you, with this, but when I started to realize how many times I'm not actually asking for what I want or just straightforward saying what I'm trying to say, I'm like saying something and I'm counting on you then saying the other thing, and then that will lead to the situation that I actually want, you know. And how insane is that? So I remember at one point I was really using, like, I would just stop and I would ask myself, okay, is what you are going to say the shortest way between A to B, right? From where you are and what you want to achieve, or is it meandering and kind of trying to come at the subject from the backs? And it was just mind blowing, you know, noticing what I'm actually doing and have been doing my whole life. It was just like second nature to me. Another definition that I like is devotion to telling the truth. And devotion means love, loyalty, and enthusiasm. So, you know, I'm supposed to be like, love telling the truth and be loyal to telling the truth and be enthusiastic about telling the truth. Well, I'm not, you know, it's like, it's scary. I mean, if I think about like, you know, in terms of the defect dishonesty, well, yeah, God, remove it, please. Who wants defects? I don't. But yeah, that means that you have to have the difficult conversation. Oh, that one I'm not so interested in, you know. So it's like it takes a choice, it takes a decision, and I have to decide to follow that. And it still doesn't come to me as second nature. And then another one is the free expression of one's true feelings or opinions. Me, like the ultimate people pleaser, you know. It's just like, I'll be whatever you want me to be, you know. I'm not going to tell you what I think what you think, you know. In fact, I'll anticipate what you think and then I'll think it before you do. So very interesting, and a lot for sort of me to learn and to consider. But if I sort of look at what all of those things, the general concept for me, what I read from it is that honesty is my relationship to reality. So, you know, what is like, is what I'm saying actually in line with reality? And I remember my first memory of dishonesty. I must have been 4, maybe 5. And I went with my mum to the shop and I stole a chewing gum. And when we left, she smelled it on my breath and she asked me, did you steal that? And I said, no. And for some reason, she believed me, even though it was obvious that I had. But I remember like realizing like, oh, reality is not necessarily what reality is. I can choose what reality is. Reality is what I say it is, you know. And that was like a very tricky realization for a 4 or 5 year old. And I carried that into my conduct in my adult life. And now I'm here, you know, at 30 years old doing this work and like trying to figure out, okay, how do I change? Like, how do I now all of a sudden start being honest? And the best way of figuring out what I want to be doing is figuring out what I don't want to be doing. So I really like studied in inventory my dishonesty. So, all, you know, all the ways in which I'm not following the compass that's pointing due north, I'm like, ooh, doing something else. So one of the definitions that I found very helpful for dishonesty is falsely representing myself or reality. God, do I do that a lot, you know? So, and there's 3 ways in which I can practice that. One, the first way is like the really obvious way is by commission. So that's like the obvious sort of lying, cheating, stealing, you know, saying something that's not true, which I've done a lot of in my life. You know, I was also a drug addict, so I've done a lot of that. I don't so much do that anymore. But, you know, one of the things when I was sort of reflecting on this is like, yeah, I lied about so many things, especially like even related to food. Like, did you eat that? You know, have you eaten? I'd be like, no, I haven't eaten. I'm very hungry. Please give me dinner. You know, even though I'd already had a meal before. And I lied about my weight always, even though like people could see I was obese. It really didn't matter if I weighed 84 kilos or 94 kilos. Like, they can see I'm obese. Why would you lie? In fact, I even lied about my weight when I was pregnant, which is like a really important bit of information for a doctor to have. But somehow in my head, it was more important to lie about my weight than it was to, you know, make sure that me and my unborn child are cared for in the best possible way. So then there's the second way which I can practice dishonesty is by omission, right? So the first one was commission, it's like telling lies. And the second one is omission, which means like not saying something that is true or neglecting to show up in a way that is genuine. And the one of those major ones that is big for me is hiding. So hiding, firstly, I hid my eating, you know. I would literally hide in toilets and eat. In fact, my rock bottom moment was the one that brought me here, the my last rock bottom moment. I've had many, but the last one was I was hiding in the toilet eating because I was with people and it was stressful and I couldn't eat in front of them the way I needed to. So I like bought some fried goods that I didn't even like that particular food, but I didn't care, you know. And I was in the toilet and I was stuffing my face with it, and I just had a moment of like, what is happening? You know, I come from drug addiction. I used to hide in toilets and do drugs. And now I'm hiding in toilets and I'm doing fried goods. It's like it's the same. And in that moment, I had to be really honest. Well, I didn't have to be, but I was. It just hit me like, you know, clear as day. You are using medicinally. This is not about you just like food, because there's no enjoyment. Like it's a smelly toilet. You don't even like this food. What is, why are you here, you know? And the answer was, you are looking for the effect. I like the effect produced by food. That's why I eat. And so, yeah, I've done a lot of hiding, hiding of wrappers, hiding of which, all sorts of things, you know. Secondly, hiding my body, you know, like I was, the way I dressed was not, and not that I'm like, I don't dress revealingly now, but I just wear what I want to wear. Before, I literally would open the wardrobe and I would try to figure out
Gentle
how best.
reminder.
Already, oh my God, okay. Okay. I
Two
would try to
minutes.
Thank you, Robin. I would try to figure out how best to hide as much of my body as possible, like camouflage, you know. And then I'd hide my true personality. I was the chameleon, like I've said before, you know. I can fit into any group. I'll just figure out, you know, how to fit in there. And it doesn't matter who I really am. In fact, I don't even know who I really am. I can be whatever you want me to be, you know. And then the big one as well, people pleasing is lying by omission as well. I mean, it's lying by commission too, but you know, I remember I was quite surprised when I realized people pleasing is not like a badge of how good of a person I am, but it's actually, I'm thoroughly dishonest, right? It's not like I'm not a nice person and I want to please everyone. No, it's just I'm a thoroughly dishonest person and I have no integrity. So yeah, and the third one, yes, I want to get the third one in. The third way in which I can practice dishonesty is delusion, which that is the real sort of, you know, hard one, because it's the definition for delusion. Is faulty beliefs despite evidence to the contrary. So illusion is like I have a faulty belief. So it's sunny outside, so I think it's warm, and then I come out and it's actually cold. That was like a faulty belief. But delusion is despite evidence to the contrary. So I can do the same thing multiple times and convince myself still the 100th time that it will be fine. It'll be fine. I've had multiple evidence for to the contrary, and yet I will still, like, half of my brain sells, you know, bollocks, and the other half can't wait to buy it, and I can convince myself anything, like it will be fine. And I do it with food, but I also do it with activities, like, you know, oh, I can binge watch a little bit of Netflix. I can't, it's gonna mess me up. And then I also do it with people, you know. It's like, oh, it'll be fine, yeah, maybe I can have a friendly relationship with this person. No, they like just believe them when they show you who they are, what they're like, that you cannot depend on them. Just believe them the first time. So that one is really tricky because the problem is in my mind. So the mind that created the problem is not going to be the mind that solves the problem. And this requires for me to show up in sponsorship so that I can have a neutral, you know, person that can tap to the compass and say, no. Am I out of time? Yes. Okay, Robin, thank you. That can tap the compass and say, hey, you're meant to be going north, you know, and then I can realign. And so I'll wrap up on this. You know, one of the best things that my sponsor does is she shares with me her sort of struggles and her failures, because that gives me permission to show up in my mess. And I can be like, hey, I'm struggling, you know, I lied about this thing, or I don't want to declare my taxes, or whatever. And that reminds me that I'm not alone in this journey of walking, of readjusting to the compass. And I was always really sort of you know, the program says half measures availed us nothing, so I have to be perfectly honest. Well, yeah, but no, because that doesn't mean I can't fail. It just means I have to have devotion, I have to have commitment to correcting course. So that's what I have to do perfectly. I have to be committed to showing up and to being willing to recorrect course when I do get off course. And as long as I'm doing that, I'm in recovery. I have like I'm moving in the direction that I want to be. So yeah, I think I'll wrap up now because I'm out of time, but I hope I said something helpful, and thank you for letting me be of service. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Hannah. I would like to now welcome our second speaker, Tali.
Oops. Okay. Can you hear me okay? Okay, beautiful. Hi, everyone. Tali, sugar addict, compulsive overeater. Grateful for everyone doing service at the meeting. I would like to begin with taking a deep breath because I'm really nervous. And inviting my higher power in. Sunlight of the spirit, please guide me. You're in control. You're in the driver's seat. I'm in the passenger seat. I will also begin with identifying that I am a sugar addict and a compulsive overeater. Food was my best friend since I was a little girl. Always wanting, always excited about the chocolates, about the cakes, always looking at my siblings when we had shared meals like pizza. I needed the bigger slice, and I was staring to make sure, like, oh my God. And I was the youngest, so I wanted the bigger piece. And always comparing, like, oh my gosh, I didn't get a bigger piece than this person or my sister or my brother or bigger slice of cake. And I was very much obsessed with food. Growing up, my parents both worked full-time hours, so it was actually really easy for me to sneak the food, meaning making a pot of spaghetti and eating it in front of the TV and having that with cookies together. And that, you know, that became part of my cycle of it being my best friend with a TV. I was a very lonely little girl, and I used food as my best friend for many, many years. I remember running out of food in the middle of a TV show and saying, you know, I was playing, you know, pretend, and I had an imaginary friend, and I was like, let's get more sandwiches. So I got more sandwiches for me and for my best friend, my imaginary best friend, and I ate both. So the sneaking started very young, and it was really easy to sneak food. Another thing is I equate getting caught in my dishonesty with shame, because I used to like finish cartons of ice cream and then hide it in a closet. And then my dad found out and he shamed me for it. And then I felt really guilty. Or if I finished the family dinner that he prepared, he called me selfish and stuff like that. So I equated getting found out with shame. So, you know, better to sneak and never find out. To be honest, I don't remember much of my 20s in food. I know I was in the food. I was in the sugar. When I moved to San Francisco, I recall that my brother and his now ex-wife offered me money to go on a diet, a large sum of money as a goal. And I considered it for 5 minutes, maybe. And then I said, hell no, I can't do it. I need my sugar. I need my food. So that's kind of like my history. A little bit fast forward, when I met my now husband. For a long time, before like he really realized I had an issue and a lot of health issues as well. He was my co-conspirator. We, got ice cream together and stuff like that. But again, I was able to, when we moved in together, I was able to sneak the food behind his back really easily. We had kind of opposite schedules a lot. And I had hours before he came home to buy my binge food. And it was like, being in the food, I was able to like, it was a magnet to a flame or a moth to a flame. I couldn't control it. It was just like, but in my head, I was like, okay, let's try to control it by like calorie counting. I did that in my 30s. And I even did that in my 40s before program, calorie count, but I couldn't, I was never strong enough to, give up the sugar because I needed it. I remember telling a therapist, I need dessert. I need something sweet every meal, morning, lunch, and dinner. I need it. And he's like, do you know dessert is a treat? And I'm like, yeah, not for me. I've always kind of, since my 20s, I've always n known I had an issue with food and sugar. And, I tried OA like maybe twice, like one time, and then one time in my 20s and one time in my 30s, and I ran away. So that's how I can identify as a sugar addict compulsive overeater. What brought me to the rooms? A couple of things brought me to the rooms, to be honest. 10 months before I was ready to join OA, I got a diagnosis of blood spots in my eyes because I'm type 2 diabetic. I've been type 2 since I was 25, probably due to both things. I have PCOS, it's a medical diagnosis, polycystic ovarian syndrome, and I'm a sugar addict. So, and it's more common to become type 2. I got diagnosed with moderate blood spots in my eyes, and that was really scary for me. I came home crying that day to my husband. I said, I need to change. And the second sentence was, please don't make me give up sugar. So I wasn't ready yet. I then went into calorie counting again, thinking, okay, I know it's a temporary solution. It's not going to last me very long because I know I can't control it, but let me try, just to release some weight. And I did, I released some weight because I did calorie count, but the sugar was still inside. I was still ingesting sugar. It was just controlled substance. But finally, what brought me to the rooms was, well, a couple of things. One, I do have a beautiful best friend who is my Ebby, and she gave me nibbles of it. She gave me little graham crackers of it, and saying, "Hey, this is a really strong meeting. It's a beautiful meeting." So it was in the back of my mind. But she always said, when you're ready, I'm not forcing you, when you're ready. So I was like, okay, no pressure. But the gift of desperation actually came with dishonesty. Dishonesty. My husband, the weekend before I joined OA, I think it was a Sunday, and I joined OA 84L on a Tuesday, I believe. He was doing our laundry, but he went out, and I bought like cinnamon bread, and I thought, okay, it's controlled eating. So I ate, 2 pieces here, 2 pieces there. And lo and behold, it was half the bread. And then in my head, I got the screw. It's the fuck it. Sorry, excuse my language. And I finished the whole bread, and I was done. I was just saying, like the first speaker said, it was my insanity. I didn't really give a shit about. I didn't care about my body size. Sorry. I swear a lot. I don't care. I didn't care about my body size. I cared that my health was pretty, my blood sugar was pretty bad, but I was also apathetic to that. But I was really done with my insanity. I was done sneaking behind my husband's back. I was done lying and getting my binge food, eating my binge food, and then feeling guilty afterwards, and then confessing to my husband and my sister, oh, I did it again. And that was like a cycle for a long time. And going back to honesty, so that's how I was dishonest before program, just a lot of sneaking around. In my first when I first stepped into the rooms, I was scared. I was nervous. I didn't know what to expect. All I knew is that I'm done. That's all I knew. All I knew is I'm sick of myself. That's all I knew. And slowly but surely, what I did, I attended meetings every day, and I started contacting people who left their phone numbers in the chat. And I started listening to 84L podcasts, especially Step One, where I had to concede to my innermost self that I'm completely powerless, and my life is unmanageable. And what does that look like in action? Honesty is, in a way, when you're honest with not only yourself but others, you're that is an action. So I knew, definitely the first year of program, honesty also is go to in my mind, what lengths was I willing to go to and stuff like that to not only release the sugar but also to create sanity in my head, because food is everywhere. So, for instance, I remember my first trip to the grocery store, and I was really scared and stuff like that. So I rung a fellow, and we went kind of like I was it was just an outreach call, but I'm like, oh, I'm in the grocery store. Oh, I'm gonna grab a loaf of bread because I usually have this loaf of bread. And she's like, what's the ingredients? And so I read the ingredients, and the last ingredient was molasses. And she's like, honey, do you know that's sugar? I'm just like, yeah. And she's like, okay. I'm like, okay, I'm willing to put it down. Okay, I did not buy that loaf of bread. So honesty, there was not being honest with her and myself that yes, it is sugar. I read the ingredient. That is honesty. I'm putting that loaf of bread down because that is not safe for me. Honesty is knowing what's safe for me. So another thing I used to do in the first year, I did go to the movie theater with my husband. It was one of our, things to do together. And there's all, whoever goes to the movies here in the United States, they know there's like 15, 20 minutes of previews, but a bunch of it is candy commercials. So I couldn't handle it. It was too much trigger. And so what I did, I was willing, and I decided to stay outside the movie theater until the movie started. And I was able to do outreach, and out like outreach calls during that time, where like a fellow,
Gentle reminder.
oh my gosh, that is really quickly. Oh wow, 15 minutes, holy mackerel. So again, I was able to do an outreach call. They read a big book, and it was really beautiful, just that like serene time. And slowly but surely, I gained strength, and a big part of my honesty in 84 Allen in these meetings is that there's a saying, tell to be well. And I do find that saying my fears, feeling my feelings to others helps me so much with my honesty. Wherever I am, whether I'm to, you know, I battled cancer, I did cancer treatments here, I moved, you know, houses, I was unemployed for 6 months, and now I have a new job, and all these fears and insecurities come up because I'm human. And my honesty is that the honesty and powerlessness. I am powerless every single day. I have to admit, I don't have any sort of power. I'm powerless, and my life is unmanageable. And I have to say that every single day. It is a daily program. And I'm grateful. I'm so grateful for 84L. I am so grateful for fellows and for you know, for the guidance of sponsorship and the big book. And I'm grateful for to be here with you and be honest where I am. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Tali. And I would like to welcome now Cheryl, as our third speaker.
Hi everyone, I'm Cheryl, a compulsive overeater. I might just start off. I know we've already read it, but I might read it again too because I'm very nervous too. The set aside prayer. God, please set aside everything I think I know about my recovery, my spiritual path, and you for an open mind and a new experience of my recovery. My spiritual path, and especially you. It's actually really great to be here today. I'm not normally available on a Sunday, but I really felt God saying it is good to give service. And He's certainly been very good to me over the last 4 months. So I've been asked to share on the principle of honesty, where I've been, what I've done, and where I am now. So basically, this disease has led me into the very depths of despair. So the truth is, I've come full circle with it. I started out in OA 17 years ago. I had been sharing with a friend at church that I just wished I could stop eating, and she'd asked to come over. So we were talking, and she told me about OA, how she'd been part of a group that had been meeting in our city. But she'd left and the group had disbanded. So we started meeting up. But without meetings, it was pretty hard for us to stay abstinent. So we inquired online and joined up with this pretty radical OA group where we learned Big Book recovery. They told us to go to AA and NA meetings, and that was a really awesome time. It didn't last though. The sponsors were really controlling, so we left them and we started up our own meetings. That was 17 years ago. And in that time, I've tried all different ways of recovering. I've had strict sponsors, easygoing sponsors. I've worked the steps all different ways through the OA workbook, the Big Book way. I've had 17 years of going in and out of the food. I relate to Bill before he started AA. There were periods of sobriety, abstinence, which gave me hope, but there were also periods of real despair. My weight would fluctuate between 35 kilos and my moods. Anyway, I couldn't stay stopped. How do I stay stopped? Well, an interesting question. Last year, I was in a 5 month relapse. My father had died and we were spiritually connected, so I was taking it quite hard. I came across this lady in a Big Book step study group and I started having outreach with her. She'd had 17 years of abstinence and I'd had 17 years in and out of the food. So she became my food accountability partner. I still couldn't stay abstinent. So she asked me, do you want to know what I did? Well, in desperation, I said, because like Bill, when he was talking to Ebby, I was hopeless. So I said, yes. And she told me of specific meetings she was going to, a food plan, no sugar, flour or grain for 30 days, 3 meetings a week, 3 outreach calls a day, talk to your sponsor every day. Something in me said to do it. So I did it and it was amazing. I felt great. I had energy. Some days I was hungry, but I'd just say it's only for 30 days. And I really felt God's strength in it. I never had to ring anyone and say, I want to eat. What do I do? So that was 4 months ago and all was well. I did feel to stop going to those meetings and I have another sponsor now who's more suited to my personality. But God was in it. He showed me again that a weighed and measured food plan is good for me. I actually feel safe with doing my food this way. He showed me outreach and the tools are so important. I can't go off in the day and forget that I'm a compulsive overeater. And if I lose that connection with God, I'd better pause and just be willing to sit in the pain of whatever emotions are coming up. Could be memories, feelings of betrayal, rejection, grief, or sadness. It could be this deep longing that comes up that I wish my life had turned out differently, had been easier, but if it had been, I might never have this deep relationship with God because I'm going to Him now instead of the food, which only covers over that pain for a little while. And it also covers over the deep joy and relief that's in me now that I have a good recovery. People I've met, it's actually been an amazing 17 years. So what really grounds me when food off my food plan starts calling to me? It was after the 30 days of being on my food plan, my sponsor and I had a candlelight ceremony over Zoom. And part of that ceremony talked about the act of surrender, the therapeutic process written by Harry Thiebaud. He wrote a paper in which he discussed a phenomenon which he labelled conversation, which there can be a switch from negativity, as this disease lives in my mind, to positive thinking. And he said this thinking is irrespective of a religious component. This positive frame of mind can appear under a given set of circumstances without special help. And this new state of mind had a much healthier tone to it and produces this good feeling. It's something of a spiritual nature. The person addict, which is me, I would often pick up in other areas, people, drama, getting into their business, or lately I've had the experience of going out to a restaurant and eating a bit much, not binging. I hadn't lost my abstinence, but I guess I had food that I wouldn't normally eat that much for lunch anyway. So anyway, the next day I felt fine, but the third day I felt irritable, restless and discontent. I had food cravings again. I struggled with my thoughts. Oh no, here we go again, another trip into a relapse. I needed to surrender, needed this specific set of circumstances created in my mind again so I could feel hope. So what did I do? I prayed and I came to God and I said, thank you for the last 4 months. Watch there. Hadn't really been a lot of white knuckling in it because I had surrendered. I rang someone and talked to them and it wasn't all about me either. I listened to them too and they said about their journey, taking suggestions seriously in recovery. Seriously for me, there's no other option because I was a chronic relapser. So in this, in the past, when I'd be in this phenomenon of craving, I would white knuckle it. through the day. I would watch a movie. I would hang out with dramatic people. Then that night, the obsession would be so strong that I was powerless. I had no choice. So deciding with God, not on my own, because I had no power against this disease that I've been fighting for 17 years, what are the qualities that are in my nature that I've put up this fight and have resisted surrender? It's defiant individuality and grandiosity. I get to that point where I'm unreasonable and stubborn about ringing someone. I felt embarrassed about ringing a fellow traveller and saying, I'm going to eat. The disease plays it out in my mind, romanticises it. It's okay. You'll just have one night in the food. Then tomorrow you can just carry on. But I forget that the next day I'm a mess because I haven't just eaten a biscuit. I've had some kind of crazy night in the food. There's this fog. There's this emotional turmoil. Having to let my sponsor know that I've broken my abstinence. There's heartbreak, remorse. What have I done? So what are the circumstances that make an addict give in and ask for help? Seek help. The doctor talks about signing a card. I didn't sign a card, but after 30 days of abstinence, I had this candlelit ceremony with my sponsor, what I did think was a bit weird at first, but it had worked so far, so I was really willing to give it a go. We read about this act of surrender, and I thought then, yes, this is what I need. This is it. This is the missing piece of the puzzle. This experience, this card. The patient, which is me, is coming under a protection of a higher power, a group, an AA group, an OA group, an NA group, or in whatever fellowship we need. I'm no longer managing by myself. I have help. There is that feeling that the food problem has gone. And it's a process of surrendering many times in my recovery. Surrender means cessation of the fight. And when I've ceased fighting anyone or anything, and it's not just food, you know, my mind can be followed by internal peace and quiet. There is an inability to explain the phenomenon. It can only be described as a spiritual experience from a higher power. So in my journey of overeating, binging, relapses, which majorly bring on depression, not wanting to go on another day in this journey of life, the tools of the OA program are, I believe, designed to induce surrender so that defiance and grandiosity actually cease to function effectively. When that happens, I'm wide open to reality. I can listen and learn without conflict or fighting back. I can be receptive to life and not antagonistic. I have this sense of feeling relatedness and of connection and oneness. It is the source of feeling at peace and serenity. And I'd just like to read a quote out of the big book. And acceptance is the answer to all my, it's page 417 in the big book. And acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. When I am disturbed, it's because I find something, place or situation, some fact of my life unacceptable to me, and I can find no serenity until I accept that person, place, thing or situation has been exactly the way it is supposed to be at this moment. Nothing, absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake. Until I could accept my alcoholism, I could not stay sober. Unless I accept life completely on life's terms, I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world as on what needs to be changed in me and in my attitudes. And thank you for letting me be of service today.
Thank you so much, Cheryl. Oh gosh, thank you, Hannah, Tali, and Cheryl, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope today. Seventh tradition. According to our seventh tradition, we are fully self-supporting through our own contributions. As we have now moved to virtual meetings, it is important that we continue to be fully self-supporting. This allows Overeaters Anonymous to continue to carry the message to those who still suffer. You are able to send your donations through our website at www.ad4l.info. AD4L. For those of you able to see the Zoom chat, the link will also be posted there. Thank you all for your support. It is appreciated. Next meeting. A reminder that a Design for Living Big Book OA is a daily meeting. We are based out of Melbourne, Australia. The recording from today's workshop will be available at our website, where you can also find out about other upcoming events and speakers. Visit our website at www.ad4l.info. Our new monthly speaker series focusing on the principles of the 12 steps will be held on March the 8th, and the topic will be Principles 2 and 3, Hope and Faith. We hope to see you there. In closing, I would like to thank you all for your service in coming here today. By following the 12 steps, attending meetings regularly, and using the OA tools, we are changing our lives. You will find hope and encouragement in Overeaters Anonymous. To the newcomer, we suggest attending at least 6 different types of meetings to learn the many ways OA can help you. The opinions expressed here today are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Please remember our commitment to honour each other's anonymity. What you hear here, whom you see here, when you leave here, let it stay here. Let us all reach out by phone or email to newcomers, returning members, and each other. Together, we get better. To close the meeting, will Nikki T please unmute and read the promises? Thank you.
Thanks, Robin. Hi, I'm Nikki, compulsive overeater, recovering one day at a time. The promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, they will always materialize if we work for them.